accession number 10225, reel number 2.
He would say, complex, M mother, mayday, mayday, mayday.
Yeah.
And then you go back, and one of the stations would come back to you. Now, that station would be within 10 miles, because this was the range of the dark, he said.
Yeah.
It would be within 10 miles of you. And he would then take you over and give you all instructions, you know, if you were lost. He would say, well, this is Manston here. So you knew you were within 10 miles of Manston. He would then say, switch on all your navigation lights. Once you switch navigation lights on, they would then instruct the Royal Observer Corps to look for you, and the searchlight batteries to look for you. If they detected you, the searchlight batteries would raise a searchlight upright, vertical, and then they would lay it along the ground, and all you had to do was fly along that beam.
Oh.
Until the next searchlight picked you up, and it would do the same, and you fly along that beam until you came to the airfield, which would be lit up for you.
Yeah.
They could also send up Spitfires to guide you home. All these sort of things were laid on by Darkie, you know, if you really were in trouble. And that was the wireless operator was the Darkie expert.
He knew the
procedures for calling on Darkie. If you were in any sort of trouble. He could also, of course, transmit by Morse if his set was working.
Yeah.
And he could get the aircraft out of any sort of trouble in that sort of way. If you ditched in the sea, the wireless operator carried the dinghy radio. And he took that out with him, and he set that up in the dinghy. He would fly off the kite carrying an aerial, and he plugged that into the dinghy radio, and the dinghy radio had a handle on it which you turned, and that sent out an automatic SOS. Or it had a little button on it which you could actually manually send a message on.
What sort of sound did the Morse of that period make? I sort of asked this because various Morse sounds did change over the years.
Well, I think it's pretty well as you'd hear it on the radio today. I don't, when I hear Morse on the radio, I don't hear it any different.
Yeah, it's just, I know very much in the earlier days, before the musical spark, the early Marconi Morse was more of a burp.
Oh, yes, this was a bleep rather than a burp.
A bleep.
It was straightforward carrier wave sound, a clear sound. And of course, the pitch of it depended on how where you tuned the station.
Yes, so we could get away with.
You actually tuned the station.
So no one would find anything terribly wrong if every, say, 10 minutes or so, just object of the exercise, we put in a couple of minutes of Morse code signals.
Yeah, no problem. The average wireless operator was trained, I suppose, to. He started at 4 words a minute, 6, 8, 10, 12s, 14, 16, 18s, 18s. He passed out at the end of all the courses at 18 words a minute.
Yeah.
Most operators went on to get about 24, I suppose, 24. Mm. Some of the better ones, I consider myself amongst those, would have got up to about 28 to 30 words a minute. They were keen enough on it. Mm.
Yes, I'm just thinking, these sort of 20-minute, these sort of codes that were transmitted at every 20 minutes, you said, they were specific for pathfinders.
No, they were specifically for all aircraft.
For all aircraft.
Well, each group, four group, six group, four group, eight group, whatever it was, sent out its own group book.
I see, so that's useful.
To its aircraft.
Because obviously we want to try and make this thing as general as possible.
Sure.
They
would have sent out their own group broadcast to their own aircraft. And in that they would have sent out any particular message. Now, in the Pathfinder aircraft, the navigators of the Pathfinders, being supposed experts, their jobs, this is why they were Pathfinders, they had the job of determining at certain points along the route what the wind speed and direction was at their height. so that they could determine their drift. Well, the navigators had to keep a track, obviously, of wind speeds and that, because it meant they would be drifting with the wind off track, so they had to know how much to allow for. And I'm not sure it was every hour, but at regular intervals, the navigator on some Pathfinder aircraft would pass the wireless operator a slip with the wind speed and directions that he was finding in his navigation. Yeah. Right? And the wireless operator, who had to maintain wireless silence throughout the trip over Germany, would break wireless silence and just rip off this message and just close down. Now, they worked on the basis that if there were 20 aircraft of the Pathfinders sending that message, at least one or two would get through, would be heard. And group would then compute the average speed and direction of the wind that the navigators of the Pathfinder aircraft were finding, feed it back to the groups who would transmit it in their group broadcasts to their aircraft,
yes, so they could set up.
So they could, the navigators there could have the benefit of this, of this, you know, check on their navigation.
But more or less, really, the wireless operator was along for the ride until something went wrong.
Something went wrong, yes. That's quite true. Yes,
he didn't have much to do, and then when something went wrong, he was very busy.
You could say the same of the gunners.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, they just sat there unless they were attacked. Mm. In fact, most of the crew, apart from the pilot and the navigator, had that function. I mean, the bomb aimer had only really initially one function, which was to press the tip when they got to the target. You know?
Yeah, that's it.
But in point of fact, later on, he did fulfil a very vital function working the radar sets alongside the navigator. And it was the flight engineer who went down and pressed the tip when they got to the target.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because it was all being dropped on radar. But as you say, the wireless operator, like everyone else in the crew, had his function the moment his function was needed.
Yeah.
Like the gunners had their function the moment they were attacked. Otherwise, they just sat there.
Yeah. I think when we make this thing up, we're not really going to... We'll try and avoid showing any radar equipment or anything, because we're really just going to concentrate on the wireless equipment. But it's going to be in semi-darkness anyway.
Yes,
so
yes.
It should... be a not pretty convincing thing.
Well, the wireless operator had a fairly hard seat, you can see. It wasn't all that comfortable, because his back was to the main spar, and he was sitting on a sort of bench-like structure, which was quite a solid seat. There was no real comforts to all that, you know. And you could get numb bum on that, no trouble at all, you know, after about 8 hours in the air. Got a bit binding. In fact, he also took along, of course, his flying rations, which usually consisted of a Mars bar and perhaps a sandwich and a flask of coffee. He also had his emergency, you mustn't forget, his emergency flying rations pack, which contained the silk handkerchief with a map on
and the
Horlicks tablets and the concentrated beef cubes and that in it, you know, in case he had to bail out and he was down the other
side.
But
those would all be stowed away under the little...
Well, he'd have them in a bag, little bag, or anyway, he might even have them in his pocket. Look, you can see his pencil there.
Just an ordinary pencil
by the look of it, yes. Those bare, those plain wood ones they were. You know,
plain wood ones.
Very plain, colourless wood things like that. What else can I tell you? Because he had all that going through his stuff. He had his lookout position through the Astrodome, which was a useful function because it was spotting for enemy aircraft. Oh, of course, the very pistol.
Oh, yes, the very
pistol. The wireless operator also had to have the very pistol behind him. Yeah. The very pistol mount clip was over his head, just behind his head, where he took the pistol and twisted it into the socket, plugged it in so it could fire out of the aircraft. And he carried with him, in his bag, his flight bag, he carried the cartridges for the code of the day, so that should they come back with no wireless be attacked by British ACAC as they came in, not having any identification, friend or foe, set aboard, then he would fire the colours of the day. You had to identify himself. He also carried an Aldous lamp, with which he could do visual signalling, from aircraft to aircraft to aircraft to ground. He could also do that sort of signalling. The only thing he didn't do was flag wig wagging.
Yeah, that was the only thing.
But otherwise he could do that. Otherwise, between group broadcasts, it was probably all a case of Vera Lynn on the BBC, you know, for him. Which we did a lot of. The rest of the crew didn't want to hear it, of course. They were too busy with their various functions and jobs.
But what happened if a... Was it a... But if you were tuned to Vera Lynn, you couldn't pick up any emergency messages?
No, you'd be listening to the BBC.
And
it's been a while. The operators did that the whole time. So right, the group broadcast's over, right?
Group broadcast's over. Let's think
for 20 minutes. Let's have a bit of the forces program on. And he could, of course, feed that into the intercom.
Yeah.
It was all linked up because by turning the switch. But what the other thing the wireless operator had on his bench was the call light.
Ah.
Now, that was quite an important function because when he was off intercom,
yeah,
doing his job, either transmitting or receiving, whatever it might be,
yeah,
he was not connected into the intercom.
I see.
And if the pilot wanted him, then the pilot would press the call light button,
yeah,
and that would flash.
Where would the call light be?
It was down by the set here somewhere, down the
It'd
side
be down,
here.
Down the side somewhere.
Yes, it's all down the side there.
It'd be just off that side.
And it'd just be a little light, a little tiny bulb, you know, in it, and it just
sort of colour
flashed was white.
Just a little white light.
White light, yes, it just flashed on and off. 1, 2, 3, 4 would be the wireless operator, 1, 2 would be the navigator, whatever, you know, and that's a sort of auxiliary lighting. And... So, all in all, I suppose the wireless operator did do quite a lot of work when they were not on operations. That is, when they were on perhaps a navigational cross-country exercise,
yeah,
or something like that, where the navigator would make use of the wireless operator to check his navigation.
Cool. Switch it off now.